They're bad. They're boys. And occasionally, they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back.
Baby, come back. But bye, 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 bye. But bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave.
Bye, 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 bye. Hello, listeners. This is an old interview, but it's a new interview. What? How does that work? Well, it works by us being utterly useless. Who could have guessed? We interviewed Beth a while back it wasn't straight after she had absolutely smashed the Bob Graham round, because we wanted to give a bit of distance between our interview and that event so we could talk more about actually her career as a whole and her life in running. We then forgot about the interview, and also at the time we'd interviewed loads of people who were doing FKTs, and so we thought we'll give a bit of space before we release another FKT episode, because we were just a bit overrun with conversations that were just, I went and did this long thing, it was quite hard. And so we wanted to be able to give Beth what we thought was a fresh breathing space.
So she has, you know, the full use of the oxygen available to her.
Exactly. So this is our 100% oxygenated interview of Beth. If you've listened to Beth in the past, she goes over some similar themes, but actually it's really interesting when she talks about her transition from her, you know, having done team sports as a rower, into running and the isolation of running, which is something we haven't really discussed that much on the podcast before. So without ado, take it away, Nick. So do Badders. We talked about Beth a fair bit in the last few, ever since her monumental run in taking the Bob Graham round by such a huge margin that just everyone's jaw dropped to the ground. But doesn't need much of an introduction. She is the fastest person to ever run, first female to ever run the Bob Graham round. It is the lovely Beth Pascal. Yay! How are you doing?
Hi guys, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm good. I'm very good. We were just saying before we started recording that I've got an ankle injury at the moment, so I've been a bit miserable about that recently. But I'm all the better for chatting to you guys tonight.
How did you do it? Having gone up all those huge hills and gone through varied terrain for, you know, the whole of the Bob Graham round, what actually caused you to turn the ankle?
I think it was just bad luck. I was supporting a friend actually on a Bob Graham round and just slipped. Yeah, it was pretty. It was dark and it was crappy weather. I just slipped. I don't know. Sometimes I think, like, why on earth did it happen? Like, it never happened before. But then sometimes I think, why did it not happen before? So anyway, I think I was due an injury. It's not a bad time to be injured, to be honest.
Might also be, I guess, if you're not concentrating on yourself in the same way, you're more likely to have a kind of lapse of judgment or a slight slip.
Maybe, but I slip and fall over all the time and don't hurt myself.
Did your friend complete the Bob Graham, or was it abandoned because they had to rescue you?
No, they had a great round, actually. Got round in 19 hours and in really, really rubbish conditions. So, big shout out to Joe Farnell for doing that. Luckily, he didn't stop and wait for me, actually. He just ran off. But I was nearly back of the car at that point.
I only had to crawl for 2 hours back to the car, but great run.
Have you seen the film Touching the Void? It's based on that weekend.
yeah. So
see, we've never talked about that, the etiquette of, because we always assume that the support runner is going to be able to keep up the whole time because they're not doing as long. Is that discussed in advance? Is there an etiquette for what happens if you're fine but your support isn't?
I think it's just assumed that you just carry on. Yeah. It happens quite a lot, really, that you, either someone gets an injury or someone just can't keep up. You just carry on unless it's, you know, they're, you know, unconscious, then yeah, you just carry on.
And would you, would you, And because because they're obviously running without all the extra kit. So would they then take, say, your rucksack, your bag until the next point?
Well, you usually have more than one support runner just in case something happens to one of them. So, yeah, when in this situation, I just gave the kit that I was carrying to the other guy that was supporting and he ran off with it and just left me to hobble off the mountain. So it's always good to have more than one support runner.
So kind of, going back then to when did you get into the fell running scene?
It was probably about 6 years ago now. I read Feet in the Clouds, as many people do, and I got really excited about the Dragon's Back race. And that was probably one of the first fell races I did back in 2015, I think. And actually since then I haven't done a whole lot of fell running. I've really considered myself a trail runner, so I think that was why, in part, when I came and did the Bob Graham, people were a bit surprised because, you know, I hadn't really done a whole lot on the fells. I have, you know, I enjoy running on the fells and on the trails. I have no real preference. It's just I think I'm better at running long distances, and most fell races are kind of short and trail races are kind of long, so that's why I've done more on the trails. I think I've always been all right at running on rough terrain.
Did you always run, were you a long distance kind of ultra runner before reading the book, or had you been working on shorter races?
No, I basically started off with long races. I had always run a little bit, but I didn't. I was actually a lightweight rower at university, and then quit that and just did a little bit of running for a couple of years or so. Started picking up a bit more and, yeah, started doing some long trail races and things. But, yeah, I never went through that stage of being like a 10k runner, then a marathon runner. I just went straight in there with 100 miles, pretty much.
And you know, how was that first race, and what do you think drew you to doing something so far removed from what I assume rowing is quite a short endeavor?
I think it was purely curiosity, because it's, you read about it and it's just crazy, isn't it? Like, I think before I read some books, so I said Feet in the Clouds, and I probably read, well, I read Born to Run, maybe Dean Karnazes' book as well. And it just sounded so crazy that I just wanted to try it. So that's why, I thought running a marathon would be, you know, would be manageable, but I wasn't really interested in that. I just wanted to, yeah, it was purely about, yeah, trying to see what I could do. And it wasn't about running fast or trying to do well in races. It was, yeah, I just wanted to see if running 100 miles was possible. And then it kind of came later that I realised I was okay at it and started taking it a bit more seriously.
Because looking back now on that first one, like how well would you now rate your preparation?
Terrible. But I think, I don't know, other people probably prepare even worse. It can't have been that bad because I didn't do, you know, too badly. I think I've always done a lot of exercise in various forms, and I just have that endurance base. So whatever I did in preparation for running 100 miles, I was always going to be like reasonable at it, I guess. If my actual running in the build-up was foolish.
And just to contrast with Jodie, what was your first time for a 100-miler?
My first 100-mile was the Lakeland 100, and I think it took 26 hours something.
Oh, that's close, Jodie. What was yours? Yours is about, I mean, yours was a flat course compared to Lakeland, but...
Yeah, all right. Why do you make everyone compare their time with mine? I don't understand.
Because I haven't done 100 miles.
What's your 100-mile time, David?
Why we need the benchmark of a Jodie, Steve.
Compare 25:46, my first. That was my...
Well, you trump me.
It's South Downs way. I don't think it's quite the Lakeland 100, is it?
And were you living in the lakes at the time, or because that's a tough 100 miler to start with?
No, I've never lived in the lakes. I did drive up there quite a lot and train on the course, but no. I mean, it's actually for a 100 miler, there's not that much climb. It's kind of, it doesn't go to the top of mountains, it kind of goes over passes, and actually it's quite, you know, it's not flat, but it's rolling and runnable, a lot of it. Yeah.
And do you think at the end of that, did you get a sense that, you know, you discovered something that you thought, I want more of this, you know, this is something I want to get seriously involved in?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I did it, I planned to do the race and then that would be it. I would never have to run 100 miles again. But yeah, after I finished, I was pretty sure that that wasn't going to be the end of ultra running for me.
And what was it about? What did you experience that was different that you thought, this is what I like?
I think it's cool just, you know, exploring new places. So I hadn't actually spent that much time in the lakes prior to training for that race. And I really enjoyed like the, just, you know, discovering somewhere that I didn't know very well. And I really enjoyed, just the scenery and stuff, I guess. And I think being good at it helps. Like you're always going to enjoy it more, like if you're reasonable at it. I think I was a little bit like lacking in direction with where I wanted to go next with like sport. Because when I was a rower, I'd taken that quite seriously for a few years. I was training with this high performance squad with a lot of full-time athletes and things, and it just became such that I couldn't make it work with like the latter years of medical school, which is why I quit. So I was kind of I knew I wanted to get into something else, and I hadn't quite found out what that was, I guess. It just kind of, as soon as I did the Lake 100, it kind of clicked, and I thought, yeah, this is for me. This is what I want to do.
Was there anything about that first 100 miler that really surprised you or shocked you? Because obviously it's one that you've been building up to for a while, and you know, read the books and you thought, oh, this is something I really want to do. Was there anything about it that you weren't expecting that happened during it, or an insight you got about yourself or about the way that you know, the way that your mind processed doing that kind of distance that kind of changed it as well?
I certainly surprised myself physically, because when you're doing these things, you don't, you know, when you're doing a training run, you don't run for more than 30 or 40 miles. So certainly I surprised myself physically that I could still run at the end. And so I came second in that race, and it was Debbie Martin-Consani who won. And I kind of looked up to her as this superhuman elite trail runner. And the fact that I wasn't that far behind her really surprised me as well. I think they were, kind of the positives I got from it. And also it's such a cool race. The community there is really, really cool. All the checkpoints are really cool. It just seemed like a lot of fun, I guess, and not too serious, which I think is what I'd struggled with the rowing a bit. It was all a bit elitist, and
has anyone ever done rowing casually? Does that exist? Like, whenever anyone's a rower, it's like 110% rowing, or you're not doing it at all. It seems to be that kind of sport that you just don't go, oh, I'll dabble in it for a bit and enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people do, but for me, like, it's not like, most of the time, it's not that fun. like you're doing the training for the sake of doing the training, and there are occasional times when like you have a great session and the weather's nice and it's all lovely, but I don't know, a proportion of like when you're doing a session, I'd say running probably 80% of the time I enjoy the training. and rowing, it was probably, I don't know, 20.
Wow.
maybe I'm being a bit hard. too little, but it's a bit miserable. There's a lot of time like on the ergo, on the rowing machine, in the gym, just staring at a screen and sweating.
And is that why you wanted to switch to running, because you were, because of your medical degree, it was a contrast for your medical training, or was there something else about it that put you onto it?
It was, yeah, when I started running again, it was purely because it was easy. Like, if you're really busy, running is the easiest thing to do, isn't it? Like, you don't need, you can do it at any time of the day for any length of time. So it was just the easiest thing to do. And it wasn't like I hadn't run before then. I'd done a fair amount of running at school. I did a lot of cross country and athletics and things. I was always the weird one that enjoyed cross country. So it kind of like was a natural thing to do when I thought I need to, maintain some level of fitness.
And did you miss the club element, the team element of rowing? Was that something that was a consideration as well? The fact that running is in many ways a personal pursuit. Did you have to adapt to that, or has that just been fine?
Yeah. No, it's something I haven't thought about for a while, actually, but I really, really struggled for probably 2 or 3 years with after I stopped rowing, because it was such a big part of my life. Like my whole, like all my friends, like my social circle, it's what I did. Like I didn't, medical school was fine. It was just kind of getting it done. But that wasn't really like, I didn't really see, I almost felt like an outsider at medical school, I guess, and I was just a rower. So when I quit, it was really hard, really hard. I couldn't, like, when anyone talked about rowing or if I thought about it in any way, I would get really low, actually. I had to completely remove myself from it. It was really hard. And certainly when I started running again properly a few years later, that really, really helped.
Was that a lack of identity, or more a lack of connection?
Probably both. It was partly, you don't have contact with all your friends, well, you have less contact with like your friends and things. And it's also about, I think I felt a bit lost, like I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And medicine is fine, I enjoy it, but it's never been like, it's never been something that has completely satisfied me on its own. I've always kind of needed something else. And yes, I'm, I enjoy it and I'm passionate about it, but I just could never that be like the only thing I do. And I don't know why. If I didn't run or do any exercise, I don't know what I'd be like. I might be chronically depressed. I don't know, because I've never really had a long period without doing any exercise. It was really tough actually when I quit rowing. And I think it would be the same if for some reason I could no longer be a runner. It's just not having that kind of sense of purpose and direction and drive. And I guess it's a little, I mean, now I said I'm injured, and I guess I have a little taste of what that would be like now. Just I'm not very good at dealing with being injured, and it's just all the uncertainty and and I know this is like a really minor thing in the grand scheme of things, but still it has a kind of a profound effect on you, I think.
I think when you don't expect it as well, when it's just something that it feels avoidable, and then it suddenly knocks you off for your all of your plans, really. So did you then, like, did you fully throw yourself into training after that first 100 miler then? Was that the moment you thought, great, this is going to be my new rowing, I'm all in?
Yeah, but I mean, it was several years later, really, that I thought, I'm going to be like an elite level or professional level runner. I still was something that I thought I could be a serious hobby. So yes, I was training a bit better. I wouldn't say properly. It took a few years before I'd say I trained properly.
And what would you say the difference looked like between you training properly and not training properly? Like,
I had no concept of how to train, so I thought that to run long, like run 100 mile races, you just had to run lots of miles in training. So I do a lot of, like, you know, back to back 30 or 40 mile runs sometimes, and then, not surprisingly, I'd get tired and then have like a bit of a lull where I wouldn't do very much training, and I'd be like, right, I'm going to train again. Miles. I think a lot of people do this. It's a common mistake. But I definitely didn't do any like feed work or anything like that. It was just about going out in the hills and running as many miles as possible, but not particularly consistently.
And how did you, like, what made it click that you realized that you needed a bit more structure and actually needed to work on endurance, tempo, things like that?
It was a gradual process. I'm not really sure maybe it's just spending more time with other runners and things. I started to train a bit more sensibly. So I did the Highland Fling in 2016, which was the qualifier for the World Championships, and I won that race. And it was after that race that I actually got a coach for the first time, and that's when I'd said that things kind of changed significantly, and I'd had like proper structured training and followed a plan and things. And certainly that was probably a steep learning curve at that point.
Which is amazing to be able to win that without any of that in place.
But I mean, just going out and running a lot, it's not a bad way to train. you can get to a certain level just by running loads of miles. I wouldn't say I did a whole lot of volume. Probably I do more volume now, but at the time it just seemed like a lot of miles, just with no real structure. But yeah, you can get still quite a long way training like that. But then if you get to a point where you kind of stop getting better, and then you need to kind of take it to the next level, I think, and integrate a few different sessions into what you're doing.
Of all the things that you then developed with a coach, what were the things that you think most improved you, or most improved or gave you the biggest amount of progress?
Running at different intensities. I mean, it seems really, really obvious, but I didn't really do that before. Maybe I do like some hill reps, but that was the only kind of hard running I did. So I was coached by Ian Sharman actually for a few months, and then the last couple of years I've been coached by Martin Cox, it's just varying intensity. So I don't do I do my long runs at the pace that I'll be aiming to run whatever race I'm doing at, roughly, I might throw some sections of sort of faster pace into the longer runs, or I do moderate runs, and different types of, I don't know, various types of sessions. So I think it was purely running at different intensities, which I don't know, seems to me as an ultra runner before, I didn't understand why you had to do that, but now I understand and it's really obvious.
Because I think it is a kind of a common sense thing where you think, well, you know, people do that for marathon training. But if you get up to like longer and longer distances, surely, you know, time on the feet, you know, conditioning, those kind of distances, you know, speed work doesn't matter as much. So I think it's like a common mistake that everyone makes who does ultras looking to improve by thinking it's just more and more long, slow runs at longer distances, you know, trying to stay injury free. Like the idea of doing, you know, shifting intensity, maybe doing some hill reps or something like that, but the idea of shifting intensity and trying to, you know, do it faster or anything, I think is a lot of people don't expect to do that.
No. And doing the long runs at kind of race pace is still like the most important thing you're going to do in the build up to an ultra. It's not like I would just do speed sessions and then run 50 miles or 100 miles. Like it's so you can get quite a long way by just doing the long runs. But yeah, like it made a huge difference when I started trying to run a bit faster. So it, even now in the build up to like a big race, I will big 100 miler, I'll be doing, you know, at least one or maybe two sessions a week of a higher intensity, either hill reps or something else.
And in those, because looking kind of down at your racing CV, you've had some of the early years, some quite big challenges all in the same year. So I think you're doing things like the spine and the dragon's back, and then also branching out into a triathlon and running marathons. But do you think you've got the balance right along the way of when to race and how and what intensity and distances to mix up?
I think so. I think that year you're referring to when I did do a lot of like long races, but I probably wasn't doing that much volume of training in between. And probably over the last couple of years, I've learned like how much I can do in a period of time whilst, you know, being able to run these races well. So I think before probably I wasn't running at the same level, and the results were perhaps less important, or I probably wasn't performing at my best. But now I think I've kind of worked out, you know, what's the minimum amount of time I can have between big races, and how I can kind of, how long in the year that I can train really well for. So I don't kind of do like really high volume training all year round, but I might do it for a few months around big races and things, but have periods where I'm training a lot less. So I think I have kind of worked out that balance with the help of Martin, my coach, over the last couple of years.
And how, like in your mind, which types of races are more exciting for you? And do you think you'll be more attracted to, because you've done a lot of the big ones. You've done UTMB, you've done Western States, but you're also doing a lot of the World Trail Champs and Sky Races. How do you decide, what do you think attracts you to a race? Is it more the competition or the records?
Yeah, it's the competition for sure. I mean, other things come into it, like, you know, the course and things. But yeah, it's, for me, it's a competition. I think I've kind of settled on, you know, I'm a 10 hour minimum as a race. If it's shorter, it's kind of a bit too short for me, up to 100 miles. So that's kind of what I think I'm best at, 100K to 100 miles ish. It's all about the competition. So the races like UTMB and Western States are what right now like excite me most, I guess. And even though it might seem a bit boring because I've done them before, there's nothing else that kind of drives me as much as those races.
I think as well, in longer races, it takes so long to actually get bored of them compared to running a local 10K, because there's so many more elements and factors, and you're going to forget a lot of it, but also there's so much room for improvement.
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly for me at UTMB, I haven't had my best race there yet, hopefully. My husband always says that he sees me at my worst at UTMB. Every year at UTMB, I'm at my worst. And maybe no one can ever have a perfect race there, but
I hope he doesn't say on the start line. I hope that's
you wake up in the morning.
Pep talk, I've got to say.
Actually, he only said it recently. I had no idea that he thought that I always look so bad at UTMB. It's because I always cry at UTMB because something's always going wrong.
What's gone wrong then at those races?
The first year I DNF'd with hypothermia.
And was that not knowing the conditions or not fueling right or not having the right kit?
Yeah, not having the right kit. I thought, being British, that if I just took the mandatory kit, I'd be fine. I was wrong. It was very, very cold that year, lots of snow and rain and everything. And then the following year, actually had a reasonable year. That was the year I came fourth, but probably I took it a bit too easy early on, and was just a bit too cautious. And then last year, I was fifth, and I felt crap from about 10K in. I had some stomach issues, I almost stopped at the 20K aid station. But somehow I kind of ended up in the top 10 early on, probably because other people were having issues as well. And I just felt terrible all the way. And I told myself, as soon as I'm outside the top 10, I'll stop. And then it just never happened, so I had to keep going.
And in your head for those two races, did you have a position that you think you would have been happy with?
Well, that elusive podium spot would be nice. I know the podium is kind of 10 people for big races. I mean, when I came fourth, I was actually only 26 minutes off first place. It was a really close race. So yeah, I think it's difficult to kind of aim to win these races, because you can have the race of your life and someone else runs faster and I'd still be really happy, you know. Top three would be nice.
And if you were to look back on that time, what do you think, if things had gone well, how much leeway do you think you've left to get a perfect run?
I think I know the course really well. I know the race really well. I don't see why I can't have a good race there. I think I'm kind of excited about next year. Fingers crossed.
And is UTMB the pinnacle for all the races you could do? Is that the one you want the most, would you say?
Well, it'll be a close call between that and Western States.
Ooh,
what is it about Western States that drives you so much with that then?
It's just a really cool race. I think it's the history of it.
Yeah.
When I went there last year, I wasn't expecting to like it that much. I thought it might be a bit too American and a bit fast and runnable for me. not too easy, but just I didn't think it would suit me. I just loved everything about it. I loved it's a small race, so it's very different to UTMB, and it all feels kind of like small and intimate. Whereas like at UTMB, sometimes when it's crowds of people and all the cowbells and things, that there's been times where I've just put my hands over my ears whilst running through aid stations and just wanted to scream like, shut up, I want to be on the mountain on my own. but Western States, yeah, it's I don't know, it's because it means, like, every single person there, the race means so much to them, because some of them may have been like waiting for 10 years to get a place and things. Like, it's just, it's so important to everyone there. I think that makes a big difference.
And having done it now, because you came fourth there as well, which is another unfortunate position if you came for that podium. Which of the two, now that you've run both, would you say you think you're more likely to have your best result in?
Probably, I don't know. Probably UTMB, to be honest. I think I've always been better on the mountains. I'm better at running slower rather than running faster. I think I can do well at Western States as well, so I don't know.
And do you get a sense that you're now a known name by everyone competing at both those races? Are they looking out for you, looking at over their shoulders?
Maybe, I don't know. So certainly going at Western States last year, no one was expecting me to do very well at all. I run far, have this, like, I don't know, people like get to vote for who they think is gonna win the race and things, and I was like, I don't know, 30th or something, or maybe even lower than that, I'm not sure. Like, no one rated my chances of doing well.
Well, I mean, that makes sense though, doesn't it, if it's a mainly American website where people are voting based on what the general public know of mainly American news. And so then with the Bob Graham round, because, I mean, I just was blown away by your time. It was just so fast. Has that been something you've always had? You mentioned Feet in the Clouds. Was that something you always wanted to go for, the record?
No, I never really thought about the record. I always wanted to do the round, just because it's, you know, something everyone should do, isn't it? But I just put it off, I guess, because I'd just prioritised races over the last few years, and I'd always assumed that I would be going for the second fastest time. I thought Jasmine's record was completely beyond reach, and even when I decided to do it this year, I really struggled to kind of convince myself that I should go for the record rather than just go for the second fastest time. I still, you know, would have, the day before, would have bet against myself for breaking the record. But yeah, I think I did a lot of training on the course and things, and I did a few training runs at Jasmine's pace. And I realized I could run, you know, at Jasmine's pace for one or two legs at a time, and it didn't feel completely ridiculous. I thought the record might be possible, but I'd have to have the run of my life to get close to it.
So, I mean, does that then mean that you basically messed up because you paced it completely wrong from the start? Well, from fairly early on, as I gather.
It's weird because you're running I've never done a race where I've run to a schedule. I've just run to feel, because I've done a lot of long races now, and I kind of know what pace is sustainable for 10 hours or 20 hours. But then going into the Bob Graham round, even though I'd written my schedule quite meticulously going off the splits that I'd run in training, it's just not the same when you're not carrying a pack and it's not raining and you've got fresh legs. So I went off at a pace that felt, you know, the type of pace that I could sustain for 15 hours or so. But having those splits on paper in front of you, it did make me worry a little bit. But I just had to, trust my instincts and run at the pace I felt like I could run at. And if I didn't have that schedule in front of me, I would have run at exactly the same pace, you know.
And were you taking off chunks with pretty much every hill that you went over, every fell, or was there a point at which you really stepped up?
No, not really. I did just gradually chip away the whole way through. That was it really. I think my schedule was still pretty good by comparison. But yeah, I just gradually chipped away at it. There wasn't any times where I had low points and things and lost time. It was just a steady process.
And what's the response been? Because I think a lot of people were surprised by just how much time you took off.
Yeah. I think as I alluded to before, I haven't done much on the fells really at all. Everyone kind of sees me as a trail runner, and most trail runners aren't that good on rough terrain, kind of a different skill. And no one expected me to break the record, but I didn't expect myself to break the record either. And I think it was purely because no one thought I could run on rough terrain, just because I haven't done it a whole lot lately. But actually, I do kind of have a background of running in the fells, and I've always been pretty good on rough terrain. So I think that's what surprised people the most. Apparently, on all the hardcore fell runners forums, no one had heard of me. Who is Beth Pascal? she's that girl, she's done UTMB or something, and I don't know. It surprised people, I think, but it surprised myself as well.
And do you find that there are these pockets of completely different communities in the running world? Because you mentioned about going to Western States, and then there's the UTMB crowd. You've got your road runners, you've got your 100 milers, Centurions, and then the fell runners. Do you think there needs to be kind of more crossover between them, and are these identities dramatically different?
I think, yeah, you're right. It's getting very complicated these days, isn't it? because you can be an ultra runner and the crowds are different. Like, you've got your 100 mile ultra runners, and you've got your sky runners, who can also call themselves ultra runners and things. So it is a bit confusing. And there's no reason why you can't. Lots of people race lots of different distances. But I think if you're going to, with the exception of a few people like Killian, you kind of have to settle. If you want to do well, you can't do well across all disciplines. So you kind of have to, find your niche, I guess, and not stray too far from that, in my opinion.
Although, your results would almost suggest, though, that actually you're able to do that.
I don't think so. I mean, I can run reasonably well in 30k or 50k sky races and things, but I'm never going to be the best sky runner in the world. I guess looking at all the races I've done, it would seem that I was quite confused about what type of runner I wanted to be.
But do you think doing all of them though has helped, in the sense that you've gained something from each of them, or it's been a distraction actually?
Well, certainly it was useful to kind of find out what I was best at. I think I know what I'm best at. Perhaps if I was mixing it up too much, it would be it would be distraction. Certainly I do think it helps. I do think it really helps, because you need to go through that process of finding out what you're good at. And I realised that, 24-hour races probably weren't for me. and that's a good thing to find out.
That sounds like a few things went wrong.
I had a one good one. But they're just dull, aren't they?
for some of us that run 100 miles over 24, they are 24-hour races for us, so we don't have a choice. We've got a question, got a few questions from Dew Ballard actually, which I thought would be worth asking. There's one from Dan Moody. Are there any recent records or FKTs that you think are exceptional, or conversely are temptingly within reach?
Mm.
So rate as in FKTs that I would go for, or FKTs that other people have done?
Other ones that people have done that maybe you've seen and thought, oh, I could do that, or ones that you've been really impressed by.
There are a few that I've thought about, but just scare me too much.
Which ones, for example?
I'm not really sure I should say. So, okay, I'll make it clear that if races are going ahead as normal next year, I will not be doing FKTs. I'll be racing.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of male records on various rounds that are within reach, which I think are within reach.
Oh.
Potentially.
That would be brilliant.
There aren't... obviously there's Jasmine's record on the paddy and the Ramsey, which I guess I have to assume are within reach. But probably if I did something else, it would be going for a male record on something.
And does that make it a lot more appealing to you to be able to take the overall crown?
I think so. I think there's, I mean, FKTs aren't, some FKTs are, if I wanted a FKT on something, there are plenty of things I could do, but it wouldn't be the same as kind of putting yourself out for and going for something that was seemingly completely beyond reach, which was what the Bob Graham was about, I guess. There are things that I would do, but yeah, no plans at the moment.
And do you get any of your sponsors kind of suggesting races or suggesting in certain FKTs because they know that they're the ones that are actually going to get the media attention?
No, I mean, I think I'm lucky in that the races that I want to do are also the races that Salomon would want me to do. Mm. If I decided I wanted to go for some obscure race in, I don't know, somewhere, they'd be like, maybe you should do UTMB instead. The things that I want to do are the things that sponsors would want me to do as well, I guess.
Mm. And we've got some other questions. How do you balance the amount of training you have to do with also being a doctor?
So I think it's important to accept that there are going to be certain times, certain parts of the year in the build up to big races which are going to be like uncomfortable and seemingly unsustainable. So I used to be like all about rest, you know, and not pushing myself too hard and making sure I got enough sleep and things. But I'm almost going the other way now and thinking that in order to like do well, you're going to have to be tired for a few months.
Oh,
and,
really?
And risk kind of overreaching a bit. So it's not always that easy. Like I do lots of night shifts and long days and things. And I'm almost always sleep deprived. I'm a bit sensible. Like I don't do any hard sessions sort of when I'm on night shifts or in really intense periods at work, just because the recovery would be rubbish.
Mm.
But at the same time, I like in my build up to the Bob Graham, I was training really hard and I was working hard. I was doing extra shifts like during COVID and things. And I felt a little bit broken most of the time. But it paid off, you know, but now I'm kind of, I've got nothing going on at the moment. So I've been backing off. I mean, obviously I'm injured now, but it's not sustainable all year round. So then I have a bit of periods where I kind of recover a bit and still training is, you know, reasonably, but But yeah, like you can't train. I wouldn't be able to train like I did for Bob Graham all year round. That just, I would just break. But I think for short periods, you just kind of have to accept that you're going to be tired. And yeah, life's going to be, it's going to be really hard for a bit. But
and does it, yeah, does it make it
taking?
Does it make it harder to actually? Because I'm very metrics driven, and I'm always monitoring on how each session's going. When you're going into that deep level of tiredness, does it make it complicated to actually get a sense of how well you're actually running, given that build up of tiredness? And how do you get that balance of just going a bit too deep into tiredness and kind of risking injuries and burnout?
I think that, yeah, I think it's really difficult, because I don't think I've got to the stage of, well, I haven't got, I'm not burnt out. But I think it's really useful having a coach who can pick up on little things that I might not realise. So there's a difference between like going for a run and having a bad session because you've had 2 hours sleep for the last 3 nights or something. But then it's picking up on when, you know, you've had a week of bad sessions and there's no real reason for it in things. So having a coach kind of helps with that, and then you can back off a little bit if that happens. I've forgotten the first part of your question now.
That covered it actually. And are you always listening to your body? Like, do you get a good sense of knowing when your body's on the edge of something turning into a niggle, turning into an injury?
Yeah, I mean, I've been pretty lucky until now with injuries, to be honest. But yeah, I think I do have a reasonable sense of how I should be feeling and what's normal. And yeah, I mean, I guess the hardest bit is after a big effort, and it's kind of having to listen to your body so carefully to find out when you're ready to start training again. And that's something that I am still trying to get right, I guess, but I've learned a lot about myself and how long it takes me to recover after big efforts. But I've never got to the point where I felt like I've overtrained. Probably I've come back a bit too soon before and then had to back off again. But yeah, never really overtrained in the build up to a big race.
Now, we've got a question from an Ants Adventure, and he's asking, which mountains or kind of hills do you typically train on to prepare yourself for the Alps?
The lakes in Snowdonia. So either really, like, I go to Snowdonia quite a lot. They're both kind of equidistant away from me. And so one session I do is I do reps of Snowdon. And I've done that a few times in the build up to UTMB, because it's quite a long climb, and there are lots of different trails up Snowdon, and most of them are reasonably good trails, which, you know, the Alps are usually, the trails are usually good there as well. So it's kind of similar. So I'll run up one way, down another way, up a different way, down another way, and I'll do that a few times, and that's a really good session. But yeah, I just try, and when I'm training for running in the Alps, I try and stick to the trails that are going to be most similar to alpine trails. So in the lakes and Snowdonia, to be honest, it's often difficult to find appropriate routes because there's a lot of really rough ground. I spend a lot of time in both.
Amazing. Have you got any more questions, JD?
No, I think we've covered it. I think there were a lot of other questions around things like, what do you prefer, Western States or UTMB? But you've answered those already. There's actually a couple of people complaining. Let's find this one again. Complaining about you. Victoria Henderson, less of a question, more of a request. All these doctors stop achieving such amazing things? My excuses for being slow and tired, I'm a doctor and a mum, are wearing a little thin when others in the same position keep winning things and breaking records.
So this is where you say that you're a really bad doctor. So that's why that's how you get away with it. Like, hundreds of people die on your watch. You know, it's that's the sacrifice you're prepared to make. Amazing. Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Beth. Good luck with UTMB Western States, and hopefully, well, actually, we almost don't want you to have to take on an outright FKT, because it means that Corona's still going on and you can't do all these other lovely races. But we'll be monitoring you with anticipation. And if there's anything we can do as a podcast to kind of help and support you in the future, then even if it's just voting for you so that you get a top five in the likely people to finish well in UTM, you know, in Western States.
Well, thanks, guys.
Our pleasure. Well, good luck with recovering from the injury, and hopefully see you at some point in the near future. Perfect. Cheers, Beth.
Right. Thanks. Bye. A lot.
I don't know. Sorry, you got, you did that little bit before me there. Right. One thing. Beth's definition of reasonably good is again shown up, but it's very different from my definition of reasonably good. It's interesting, isn't it? Placing second in the Lakeland 100 that is your first race. And yeah, still not knowing at that point whether it's something you want to do.
And still not thinking, maybe I should pursue this really, you know, like, yeah, maybe I'm really good at this.
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like, looking at her, you know, she as she said, she's come on quite quickly, but, you know, she's doing things like winning the Taunton Marathon and doing these really good times and really well in so many things so quickly. But it's in a way, it's a shame that lockdown happened with, because she's absolutely on the rise and you can see her just putting it all together in one of these big races.
There's something, what is it with vets and doctors or working in some kind of international development and charity? Those two professions, I don't know how many people we've spoken to now, there's no particular, but those two professions seem to produce a huge amount of like ultra runners who are really good. And I, you know, from a doctor perspective, the tiredness thing actually is a really interesting one, because they have to get used to long periods of staying alert, and, you know, that maybe like the stress of that doesn't do it. But they also seem two professions where training is just so much harder to do because of the hours that you work.
Yeah, but then, yeah, as you say, the training to be a doctor is huge amounts of work as well. But a lot of people I know are only now just been like Miller and Mene's wife. They're only just coming to the end of their rotations and finally having freedom to be working where they want. But all the way through, as you say, it's not just the number of hours they work, but the medics at our school, they nearly all were doing sports at a good level and furious drinkers as well. And so,
yeah. I mean, that's, you asked a really, really good question there when we were talking about the rowing aspect. And I suppose, you know, in terms of like, you know, rowing has a reputation of having this incredible social aspect. And it should be the doctor has a reputation of being a very tight-knit community, really incredibly social aspect and things like that. And then stepping outside of that must be really hard, must be really, really difficult, because you don't just lose, you know, it's not as if you're just changing a sport. You're losing essentially what may have been your strongest social circle.
And she's too quick to have any buddies. If she was,
yes, you need to be back.
She needs to be rubbish. They should be making friends all the way along, staying at the aid stations. But nah, she doesn't meet anyone.
Or she's just a good judge of character of normal awkward. He's like, these guys are not my people. I'm like hard drinking, hard boozing, drinking games, things like that. I'm staying well ahead because they're not going to get any of that back there. It is a bit of a shock when you go into the ultra running community, and it's not quite as hard drinking, although, you know, as a community we're trying to bring the hijinks of rowing and rugby to the sport of running.
Yeah, the thing that no one wanted That's what we're committed to.
The one aspect that people absolutely love and had probably escaped from by going to ultra running, we are bringing it right back to that temptation.
Yeah, we're bringing it back like we're bringing up our booze at the end of the night. Yeah, and it's interesting how there are these little pockets. And as you said, you know, but the difference between fell and trail, and actually that's completely different to your track runners who are doing 100 milers. And Camille's spoken of this in the past, how she's gone from being breaking all these records and going into more into trail and really looking to focus in that, and how she's not felt that she's part of that community yet. And there's almost this skepticism about this person coming in. So it's, and it's understandable why. I guess with the lakes as well, it is almost this one community that is fell running, because it doesn't really exist anywhere else in the same way. You know, you've got the Peak District, it's pretty hilly and it's got some like great places, and Snowdon, but
you're forgetting Isle of Wight.
Yeah, and the Isle of Wight, yeah, of course. I mean, in some ways the Isle of Wight is reflective of that kind of deep set community. but it's a microcosm that I don't know if that does exist in the same way in any other, you know, big countries. You know, just France, because the Alps is too big to be like the lakes, right? And America's got Boulder, but then it's got Washington for loads of trail there, and you can go to Alaska. And so I don't know whether it's unusual fell running
it's weird how running has historically been carved up, because of course it all started it made sense when it was started with like athletics clubs and carving running up into, you know, different disciplines. But as it's got bigger and bigger and it's been carved up in different ways, it is increasingly looking odd and increasingly feeling as though it doesn't make any sense. Why are these different communities carved up in these different ways based on, you know, one trail looking like that and another not being quite a trail, or, you know, even though they're running over different, and I suppose a lot of it's to do with you know, the who's responsible for the various associations that police the various races or whatever. But it is weird, because I remember when I started running, people were saying, oh, do you do road running or trail running? And I was like, that's a really weird distinction, because I don't necessarily do trail running or road running. I've just run in the area around me, which happens to be some road and some trail. I wouldn't characterize it as anything. I'm just running on the surface that I have. And it's just really interesting how she's done all those different disciplines. But really, in many ways, they're not different disciplines. They are all essentially running, but just, you know, with different rules associated and in different places. And I think it, you know, absolutely has helped. We didn't ask the question as to why she only gave a triathlon a quick bash and then ditched it. That's what we should have asked.
Yeah, I almost didn't want to mention that word in case she was tempted back. Thought maybe she'd just forgotten that it existed. And if she, you know, but what's interesting, she's done the Tour to Marathon twice. And she's come, oh no, she came first the first year, second the next year. And that is going to play on your mind, right? Local marathon. But it'll be, I just can't wait to see what she gets on with. And the COVID is, you know, creating all these unusual changes in people's priorities.
FKTs that normally we wouldn't care about, that we're actually talking about on the podcast after saying that we were never going to talk about FKTs. Literally, it's like, I think, I can't remember whether we said this before, but who cares? We're repeating everything as we are, because there's barely anything to report on. But it is like when, do you remember on TV when One Man and His Dog was on? Do you remember that?
I think I was living abroad at the time.
Right,
I think I was in Cyprus.
One Man and His Dog. Let's show their age here. This, basically, when the TV only had three channels, One Man and His Dog was on. And it basically, you watch a man control a dog, control some sheep. And that was like one of the biggest shows, okay? Now, this is like kind of like what like reporting on FKTs is like now. We've got down to One Man and His Dog territory. We are, that is what, I'm not taking anything away from the FKTs. It just feels as though these FKTs, when all this racing comes back, the FKTs will be like, oh, remember that time when we thought FKTs were really important and impressive? Like, oh yeah, that was when everybody had to stay indoors.
It's gonna be like when we're in our kind of 70s and like, guess what time I was up till last night? No, 9:45. Woo! We're so limited by what we can do. Not that simple, that is it? But well, the trouble is, we're coming into winter, and most of the races happen in the summer, so we're going to need some new content.
Please, if anyone's got any ideas for content, that would be great. Just let us know. That's the thing. It's miserable, isn't it? It's miserable. And that's the other thing. Normally, it's the misery because you're training for spring marathons, aren't you? So there is a misery, but there's a certain amount of discipline that is injected into that miserable element, and you're still running and you're still having to train and people are still talking about stuff and people are still getting excited that they're going to be doing marathon stuff with absolutely no prospects for spring marathons. Like, what is it? What's going to happen? What is there to look forward to? Nothing.
Well, you're right. And that's 1st of January is where I normally cut back on drinking and start training for
marathon. That's where I'm not going to accelerate.
Yeah. Whereas now, and it's going to be really interesting amongst individuals, but also things like running clubs where you've got something like Heathside where it might be that we can get out of lockdown a little bit more and there will be more of a resemblance of club training. But then you go to the sessions and every Tuesday session is focused around the marathon. Long runs, like your long run is because of marathon. Most people didn't do that before. And so whether that's going to continue, are people going to be knocking out 16, 20 milers?
It's weird. Yeah, that's the thing. Without that kind of element of discipline and focus.
But then people might actually rediscover that running can be 2 hours a week.
What, you can really? Run just for fun? No way.
Yeah.
There's no such thing. This whole idea that running is fun is desperately overplayed.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. That's what I want to hear. Running's not fun. I'm a lucky man. Well, thanks for listening, guys. If you enjoyed this episode, we've talked about the Bob Graham a few times. Spoke to Jasmine, actually, in the past. And originally, we spoke to James Appleton about he'd moved to the Lakes to get better at training. And he goes into explaining to us, as Southerners, all the nuances and how the running clubs and the culture and everything like that, what it is like there.
Yeah.
So those are really good episodes to listen to. We spoke to Courtney DeWalter that was focused on Big's backyard, but she's obviously one of the best ultra runners in the world. And we also spoke to Candice Burt, who organizes 200 plus mile trail races in the States. So two unbelievably good episodes there to listen to as well. But that's just it, guys. If you want to get some merch, what do they do, JD?
You go to store.badboyrunning.com. I think we've actually, by the time this comes out, we get in the group, because I think we'll be doing a pre-order for some of the new merch that we've got coming up.
Actually really good. I was amazed. So, who did you get to do this for you?
Everyone always is. Lorna gets a batch of it, a delivery of it. She goes, I opened it up and all the lettering wasn't pink. It was incredible.
But if you want to ask questions to future guests, then follow us on Instagram. We put the guests in advance and then can ask your questions directly to them. If there are any guests you'd like to recommend for us, or if you've got any feedback or stories to share with us, then letters at badboyrunning.com or david@badboyrunning.com. And anything else, Jody?
No, we'd really appreciate a review. So if you go to iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator that you use, subscribe, rate and review. It really helps us get more guests on.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening, guys. Please do that. And we'll see you next week.
See you later.
Bye.
I must admit I was a clown to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back. Yes, and give me one more.
to try, cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back.
Fuck you, buddy.